Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Glad you're with us again. On this week's show, we'll spend most of the hour on some new cybersecurity measures the Defense Department has just implemented. For the first time, DOD is taking steps to require its contractors to take some specific measures to protect not just classified information, but also some unclassified data. Under the rule, which went into effect on November 18th, contractors are also required to notify DOD when they detect that cyber criminals or other unauthorized intruders have stolen data from their systems. It's an issue DOD's been working on for more than 2 years when it first published a proposed rule on the protection of unclassified data. And as we'll hear later in the show, industry groups think the final product is a lot better than what DOD started with in 2011. Our guest for the first half of the show is Kristen Baldwin. She's the principal deputy in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Engineering. She told me about the rule and what's covered.
So the rule that we issued covers technical information, DOD technical information. We looked across the spectrum of DOD information and focused this rule on technical, which is comprised of technical data, computer software, engineering designs, other types of blueprints, materials. Really covers the spectrum of the life cycle, but from a technical information perspective.
And I assume we're only talking about information that is government-owned, correct? We're not talking about vendor-owned intellectual property?
The technical information that's covered is anything that is provided by the government or developed for the government by the vendor as part of the DOD contract.
And can you give me a little bit of background on the threat that the department perceived from the exfiltration of this information? What had you been seeing? Why were you worried about additional measures to protect this information?
So the department has been concerned about this threat for several years, and I think that it's a well-known threat. We read about it every day in the papers, about different cyber adversaries penetrating government networks, industry networks. And so we are, of course, subject to that same threat, just like our other industry representatives are. And so this is just our approach to take better control and better accountability for the importance of the technical information that we are developing.
And I think there's a perception out there that at least a majority of the information that has been exfiltrated by cyber criminals, nation states, et cetera, has been from the systems of contractors rather than from government networks. Can you say whether that's basically true?
You know, we really don't have the data to establish that whether or not that is true. What we do know is that government networks as well as industry networks are definitely subject to similar types of penetrations from these different types of actors that you mentioned.
And I realize you might not be able to answer this question in much detail and in unclassified setting, as this obviously is, but can you say anything about sort of the type and the volume of the information that you think has made its way out of these systems before these protections went into place?
What I can say is that the type of information that we're worried about losing is the type that I described earlier, which is this type of technical information. That is what the adversary or the cyber actor appears to be interested in, and that's that information that comprises knowledge regarding the way that we manufacture, the way that we design our systems, the particular components, whether they be software components, hardware components. It's that type of information that we are seeing being targeted. With respect to volume, it's not just the primary primary industrial partners that we have, but it's really the sub-suppliers down to the lower levels of the contracts that we have with our prime contractors where the information is being targeted from.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what vendors actually need to do to be in compliance with this rule. What are some of the steps that they're going to need to take?
There's two primary measures that the contractors will be required to implement as a result of this rule. First is a set of protection activities. We will require all new contracts that have technical information to implement a set of information security practices onto the networks that are going to where our technical information will reside. We call these information security practices, sometimes we refer to them as controls. So when you read the rule, you'll see a set of 51 information security controls, but they're basically information security practices that the contractors will have to implement on their networks. And the second major part of the rule levies a reporting requirement. So when there is knowledge of a cyber incident or a cyber actor that has done something on the network that contains our technical information underneath the contract that we are executing, that contractor must report to the Department of Defense that there has been a potential impact to the information.
And as far as those controls that you mentioned before, we should point out that these were not made up out of thin air just for this purpose. I think if I understand the rule correctly, they're taken directly from the NIST Special Pub 800-53, right?
Yes, and in fact, that was one of our key tenets. As we developed this rule over the last several years, we really wanted to be sure that we didn't develop something that was DOD unique or even really just federal government unique. We wanted to make sure that we were drawing from industry and known best practices and standards. Everybody has this problem, and so we want to make sure that any new requirement we levy is something that is familiar and with pedigree that will now be required for DOD contractors.
And so let's imagine a hypothetical case where a company literally implements everything in that special pub we just talked about, but yet they have an intrusion and they lose information. And then they report it, as the rule requires. Are they then basically safe from any kind of contract penalties?
That is a great question, and it's a really important aspect of this whole new rule and set of requirements. It is well known that these sets of information security practices may not ultimately stop the determined cyber adversary. But what they do is provide a level of additional cyber hygiene. You'll see in the national strategies for cyber, as well as the DoD strategy for addressing the cyber adversary, one of the key aspects of it is to implement just a basic level of cyber hygiene. This rule really does that. This rule will actually then enable our industrial partners to better understand when a cyber attacker is actually in their networks, be better able to determine, and actually will probably increase the amount of reporting that would be made of incidents that are occurring on their networks. The situation that we have now is we don't have these practices in place that allow us this visibility and transparency into what's going on in the networks. When we put those information security practices in place, we actually improve our ability to have a better understanding of what's going on. And so the result that we hope to have is an increased number of incidents reported. So the key point here is that an increased number of incidents is not a negative factor by our contractors. It's actually a very positive measure because it means that they're knowledgeable of what's going on in their networks. They're determined to put to address it, and that is the practice that we want to see happening.
Yeah, play that out for me a little bit more. Once this reporting starts flowing in and you do get some more visibility on the intrusions that are happening, I mean, what does that do for you? What can you start making? What can you start doing with that information once you have it?
The rule is focused on allowing the Department of Defense to have a better understanding of the types of information that may have been impacted or lost as a result of this cyber attack. what that allows us to do is take action or determine what the consequences might be of that information being lost. And any necessary action that we might want to consider for the future, whether that be a change to our future requirements, new technologies that we may need to be developed as part of that capability. But really, what the rule focuses on is there will be a better understanding of the department of the type of information that has potentially been impacted or lost so that we can take action appropriately.
That's Kristen Baldwin, the Principal Deputy in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Engineering. We're talking about some new requirements for DoD contractors to beef up the security of their unclassified data networks and report to DoD when there are breaches. She'll be back with us after our first break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Returning to our conversation now with Kristen Baldwin, the Principal Deputy in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Engineering, talking about a change DoD just made to acquisition regulations requiring defense contractors to give a higher level of protection to unclassified technical data to guard it from hackers and to report to DoD when they do have data breaches.
Do you have any kind of sense of how many companies, even anecdotally, are already taking the steps that are required here?
We believe that our large suppliers, the large businesses, and most of the mid-sized businesses are really already doing many of these controls. It is known that it is anticipated that small businesses may not just have the capacity right now to have focused on these controls. But what this will do, this will bring them up to a good level of cyber hygiene. We already know from our major prime partners that many of these practices are in place.
Back when you guys published the initial proposed rule back in 2011, I know you got an earful of comments from industry, and one of them was around, as you just alluded to, the cost to implement for small businesses. Are there any steps that you can take that could help mitigate some of the burden that might impose on smaller firms?
Absolutely. This is going to be something that will take industry as well as government to mentor and enable the knowledge about why and how these practices are, how they can be applied, what they're good for, and how to really tailor these practices to the specific business operations that particular company possesses. And another attribute that I would mention here is that the particular controls or industry information security practices that are identified in the rule are flexible in the way that they can be implemented. And so this is another aspect of how we tried to address the issue of some businesses will have these in place now, some businesses will have to put them into place. But the flexibility in the application of how these controls can be put onto the networks allows us to do so in a very cost-controlled manner. And what I mentioned before about this being part of a broad community effort, we anticipate and we're already seeing that our large industry partners are interested in making sure that their sub-suppliers and their small businesses that they deal with on a regular basis have that same knowledge. So just as we'll be working with the community to encourage the development of more detailed guidelines and guidance, our industry partners are doing the same with their own sub-suppliers. So this is an effort that we'll all be partnering in.
And back to that 2011 proposed rule I mentioned, are there any significant changes that you made in response to the public comments that you would point to?
We did. We did a number of things. In fact, we sent this rule out for two public comment periods. There was a predecessor advance notice that was sent out, which also we benefited from public comments during that first round, and then with the second round during 2011. And what that really informed us was the request by the public and by industry to be specific about what controls or what information security practices we really wanted to see be put in place. And so former versions of the rule just pointed to a information security standard in general, and the final rule carefully selected particular controls that would have the greatest benefit and be affordable for the distributed types of industry partners that we have, large, small, and across many multiple domains. Another major area of feedback that we got was a request for clarification on what exactly we wanted to see reported to the government given an incident had occurred. And so the final rule does in fact go through a set of very specific questions, almost a form that can be filled out and sent to the department. So those are two examples of the ways that we really did benefit from the public rulemaking process and the comment period that we got. And I think what we ended up with was a rule that can be implemented wisely, affordably, and to benefit of industry and the government.
Well, as you say, you narrowed the focus of what they're supposed to report. But another issue I know was, if I'm a vendor, how am I supposed to know exactly what information I'm supposed to protect at this enhanced level? What's the ultimate answer to that?
So the ultimate answer is we did narrow the focus to the critical technical information or the technical information category. The Department of Defense contracts for numerous types of information, and as I mentioned before, this area of technical information was well defined and historically marked or protected by the department in our own policy and regulation. And so we were able to determined that these protections that we are now going to require on contract really are most appropriate and most important for this type of information, which does include technical data, computer software, engineering designs, manufacturing designs, which when aggregated, this types of information, although unclassified, when aggregated provides exquisite knowledge to an adversary or any peer competitor as to how our warfighting systems, how our business systems, how our Department of Defense systems operate, how they're built, and what their capabilities that they provide.
And I think it's right to say that this regulation falls under the broader government-wide rubric of trying to do a better job of protecting classified information writ large. Is there any other rulemaking in this area that's ongoing that you can talk about besides this controlled unclassified information area?
Yes, it is. We are very aligned with the administration where they're going with respect to protection of intellectual property and actions against the cyber actor. Other rulemaking that is, we're also very much aligned with congressional legislation within this regard. And requirements that are now in law that relate to the protection and reporting of incidents regarding unclassified information. In addition, we're also very much aligned with existing government and industry information sharing activities that are currently in place, and you may be aware of a related rule that was published, I believe, in the October timeframe to allow these voluntary information sharing agreements to be open to a much broader set of partners and players. And it's all of these complementary activities, implementing protections on your network, reporting and of what the information implications of any cyber event are, and the the government and industry partnerships to share information regarding these threats. All of these actions complement each other very well and align with the National and Department of Defense strategies for addressing the cyber threat.
That's Kristen Baldwin, the Principal Deputy in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Engineering. She talked to us by phone from her office at the Pentagon. We'll stick with the topic of this new rule, putting some additional cybersecurity requirements on contractors, and get an industry perspective when we come back from another break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. We're spending most of our show this week on a new acquisition regulation dealing with cybersecurity in the defense contracting world. As we heard earlier in the show, the Pentagon is worried that it's losing valuable intellectual property because of the cyber theft of not just classified information, but unclassified data, too. The new rules require DoD contractors to take additional measures to secure their unclassified networks based on practices outlined in a National Institute of Standards and Technology document, known as Special Publication 800-53. We'll get an industry perspective now on the new rule. Alan Shvatkin is the Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council, a group that represents government contractors, mostly service contractors. He says from industry's perspective, the final rule is a big improvement over the proposed language DoD issued more than 2 years ago.
And the proposed rule from 2 years ago is very different than this final rule that was published on November 18th in three significant respects. First of all, the scope of the information to be covered is considerably smaller. This final rule only covers unclassified controlled technical information, which is a small subset of all of the information that was previously covered under the proposed rule. So because the scope is so much narrower, that's a significant benefit. Secondly, the data to be protected has got to be marked, affirmatively marked primarily by the government, and so there's no more guesswork from a company as to whether data has to be protected. They will now know with certainty what information has to be protected. Third, the rule lays out a set of guidelines based on the National Institutes of Standards and Technology's publication for how that information is to be controlled. And while it is not a prescriptive set of standards, and it is not a mandate, at least it removes some of the ambiguity about how a company can meet its obligation for protecting information without having to be subjected to second-guessing by every contracting agency or contracting officer, or in the event of a breach that they fail to follow industry standards.
Well, one thing that is similar to the interim rule is that this is DoD only versus government-wide. Is that troublesome to you?
No, it's not troublesome at this point because DoD is one of the very few agencies that generates this unclassified, controlled technical information. And so this doesn't supersede or preclude future rulemaking. In fact, I'm anticipating that there will be future rulemaking around basic security responsibilities of all contractors. So again, because of the narrow scope here, I'm not troubled that it is DoD only. The Department of Energy, NASA, are the primary agencies that would have this type of information. And DOE already has a rule in place, as I believe NASA does as well.
Would you say that there's general agreement that something more needs to be done to protect the categories of information we're talking about here?
I think generally, yes. I mean, there's no question that the attention to and the number, the attention to cybersecurity and protecting information is rapidly growing, I mean, both on the government side and then on industry side. I think the example, the work that the National Institutes of Standards and Technology did in developing their framework agreement, broad consultations with many of the industry sectors, very, very valuable, that hopefully will be finalized in February of next year after the last round of consultations. Those are the kinds of examples of where a collaboration between government and industry is yielding a better result than either government or industry acting unilaterally. And so I think there's a recognition that more needs to be done. It's hard to know how far individual companies, whether they be government contractors or infrastructure protection activities, are going individually. But I think we are raising the visibility and the standards against which to be measured.
In the final rule, the department seems to acknowledge that as far as implementation, the costs are going to be probably felt more sharply by small firms, whereas bigger companies probably already have a lot of the steps that need to be taken in place. What's your take on how burdensome this is going to be to implement, especially for those small firms?
Well, we've always been concerned about the cost of implementation. The two factors here, both of which I've already mentioned, that I think contribute to minimizing the cost, but certainly not eliminating it. First of all, by narrowing substantially the scope of coverage, the number of companies affected goes down dramatically. In fact, in the rule, the department estimates that only about 6,555 companies, will be covered by the rule. And so many of them will be smaller firms. But here again, even those smaller firms, if they're already dealing in this narrow category of controlled, of unclassified controlled technical information, should be doing some element of protection. The broader the rule, the more ambiguous the standards of care, the more concerned we had about the cost, particularly for smaller firms. I don't want to minimize the cost. There will certainly be some. But as we've narrowed the scope and addressed the guidelines for compliance, I think those costs will still be less on the smaller firms anyway.
And the requirements, though, flow down to each subcontract tier. Do you know off the top of your head whether that 6,555 estimate includes all those subs?
To the best of my knowledge, it does not. In fact, one of the remaining concerns that I do have about this rule is that the clause itself would be put into every contract, including contracts for commercial items and commercial off-the-shelf items, and then it will be up to the government and the contractor to go figure out whether unclassified controlled technical information is utilized in the performance of the contract. I think that's an overbroad reach and unnecessary. The government clearly knows when they're using unclassified control technical information because they have to market and who's getting that. And so I think there could have been a less intrusive step than applying this as a peanut butter spread across all contracts subject to review. The classic answer from the government is, well, it's self-deleting. If there's no data to be provided, then there's no obligation to comply. That's usually a weak argument in my view. I am concerned about the flow down. I am concerned about the broad application to commercial items and the COTS products. Everything is a trade-off. I think because we've substantially narrowed the category of covered data, that concern is just mitigated a little bit.
Yeah. Then finally, Ellen, let me just ask a dumb question about how the government exercises this. I mean, this only affects new contracts, right?
That's correct.
And so if the government decides that a company is in violation of this reg, do they have any remedies after the award has already been made?
Well, while the rule will have a prospective application, first of all, it's in effect right now.
It
will then have to be included in new contracts that are awarded after the effective date. And I'm confident that the Defense Department will make an effort to try to modify existing contracts, particularly those that have new task orders or option periods coming up, a renewal of existing contracts, to try to include the clause. And companies will have to approach that individually. My general guidance to our member companies is to try to resist modifications to ongoing contracts. But these are systems changes. These are not contract-by-contract compliance questions. So once the clause is in a contract, today or in the future, companies are going to have to figure out how to comply. The good news about the NIST standards is that it allows the flexibility for companies to apply them in a manner that makes the most sense for the size and scope and the nature of the work of the company. So they're not rigid, you know, design standards that will have to be complied with. But a violation of this clause, that is, if the company takes no action, develops no processes or protections, then there's certainly a breach. I mean, it's clear under the background information that this rule is not creating a safe harbor. I don't think we would have expected one. It would have been nice to have.
Right.
But I also hope that if there is a breach, that is, someone gets unauthorized access to the unclassified control technical information, that simply because there is a breach does not mean that there's a contract violation as well. And so we'll have to watch that in this whole area of information assurance.
Alan Shvatkin is the Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council, talking with me about a new rule requiring defense contractors to take new steps to secure unclassified data. Earlier in the hour, we also heard from Kristen Baldwin, the Principal Deputy in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Engineering. We'll take one final break and switch gears when we come back. Some thoughts from the Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, on one of his favorite topics, energy, and also the defense budget picture. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Servin. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. Rounding out our final few minutes here with an update from Ray Mabus, the Secretary of the Navy, on the Navy and Marine Corps' work in the areas of alternative energy and using conventional energy more efficiently. He spoke at the U.S. Naval Institute's Washington Defense Forum.
Energy and power are central to our naval forces, because we've got to have them to get our platforms there and to keep them there. And energy is a national security issue. Oil prices surge every time there's some instability, whether that country produces a lot of oil or not. When Syria happened, not a significant oil producer of any kind, when Syria happened, the price of oil popped up to $107 a barrel. And traders call this a security premium. Well, this security premium over the past two years, fiscal 11 and fiscal 12, has cost DOD $5 billion over what was budgeted for fuel. It's cost the Navy and Marine Corps $2 billion over what we had budgeted for fuel. Now, there are not many places to go get $2 billion. In Navy and Marine Corps that it's unbudgeted, and you did not expect. The only two places are out of operations and training. So you fly less, you steam less, Marines go to the field less. Or, if the bill gets big enough, you have to start taking it out of platforms. And I don't think either one of those is a good choice. I think there ought to be a third choice. And even if the United States does produce all the oil and gas that we need domestically, it still is the ultimate worldwide commodity. You still will not be insulated from these global price shocks. Every time somebody threatens to close a choke point, every time there's instability somewhere, oil is going to spike. And every time it goes up a dollar a barrel, it costs the Navy, Marine Corps, $30 million for that $1. So we've been doing some things. One of them is I've set some energy goals for the Navy, and we're going to meet them. That by no later than 2020, at least half of all our energy, afloat and ashore, will come from non-fossil fuel sources. Now, we've demonstrated the Great Green Fleet at RIMPAC in 2012. We took a carrier strike group. The carrier is nuclear, but every ship in that strike group and every type of aircraft that flew off the carrier, the ship sailed on a 50-50 blend of biofuels, and aviation and marine diesel. The aircraft flew on a 50-50 blend of biofuel and avgas. And you know what the big news was? No news. We put the biofuel in our normal logistics chain, put it on an oiler, which I guess is misnamed, and took it out to the fleet. And the only difference that people could see, maybe, is that it burned a little cleaner. And there wasn't quite as much gunk on the engines after. Now, I got yelled at because it cost a good bit to get this biofuel. And it did. It was a very small amount, 450,000 gallons. And it cost $26 a gallon for the biofuels. But because we're bringing the market, and because under something called the Defense Production Act, if we've got a defense need that the country cannot meet in scale, we can partner with people to get it to scale. We now have signed contracts with four biofuel companies to deliver us biofuel, 170 million gallons a year starting in 2016, for under $3.50 a gallon, which is less than we're paying for petroleum today. We're also doing a lot of stuff in energy efficiency on our bases, on our ships. We've got the first hybrid ship at sea, the USS Macon Island. She had a $33 million fuel budget on her last deployment. She spent $17 million, brought the rest of it home. And that was impressive. But the most impressive thing was when I visited and talked to one of the engineering duty officers. He said, yeah, he said, that's great. He said, but the thing that really has started changing the culture is you've got third-class seamen coming up saying, I got an idea how we can save some energy. I got an idea how we can save some fuel. And he said, that's what we're doing on Macon Island. And that's what we're beginning to do around the world.
Again, that's Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus speaking at the U.S. Naval Institute's Washington Defense Forum. He spoke for about 40 minutes and covered a wide range of topics. We're only able to get to a couple of those in the short time we have here. But Mabus also spent some time covering budget issues. He says he's hopeful Congress can reach a bargain to roll back sequestration before it takes effect for 2014 in January.
I hope we are close to two things, a budget deal and a defense bill, an NDAA, because the way we're going, it puts everything at risk. The way we're going puts at risk all the progress we've made. It puts at risk the ability to provide that presence. It puts at risk the options that we give a president. Sequestration says just take a chunk out of every single line item. It does not allow you to put money against strategy. It's just a dumb way to cut. And almost as harmful, particularly to the Navy, are continuing resolutions. There hadn't been a budget passed on time since 2005. Just think about that. Not a budget on time since 2005. I have never seen a budget on time since I've had this job for the last 4.5 years. And when you've got a continuing resolution, strange things happen. We can't put a ship in a shipyard because it's a new start. If we're going to spend more money building a ship than we did the previous year, when we reach the previous year's amount of money, we have to stop. Makes no sense. So I hope that they reach a budget deal, and I hope that it does give us some certainty, because that's the main thing you're looking for. Is some certainty. As much as I and others complain about sequestration and continuing resolution, I want to make it very clear that I'm not talking about the fact that we should not spend less on defense. We should. The American people have the right to expect that after we come out of two very long wars, that we will spend less on defense. But what I am saying is that you ought to do it in a smart way. You ought to do it in a way that supports strategy. It shouldn't be with a blunt object. And it should be with a thought of, what kind of force do we want? What kind of force do we need? What will the force be able to give this country and the presence of this country in terms of presence, in terms of options for the president?
That's Ray Mabus, the Secretary of the Navy, who played a couple short excerpts from his discussion at the U.S. Naval Institute's Washington Defense Forum. Earlier in the hour, we talked to two guests about DOD's new rule to protect unclassified technical data on the networks of defense contractors, Alan Shvatkin of the Professional Services Council and Kristen Baldwin, the Principal Deputy in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Engineering. If you missed that part of the show, we'll post the whole thing online, as always. That's it for this week's edition of On DOD. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back with you next week. I'm Jared Serbian. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.